Welcome to the December 11th, 2023 SCV Water Finance and Administration Committee meeting. And we'll now begin the meeting with the first item, which would be the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand with me. Vice President Gutzeit, would you mind leading us?
Ready
and
begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Now we'll proceed with the announcements on the procedures for tonight's meeting. And I would like to cite that all members of the committee are here tonight. To start out with, the meeting is being conducted in person at Rio Vista Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience, members of the public may also participate virtually by listening or making comments to the committee by using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link provided in the packet. In the event there is a disruption of phone or internet service, which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to the members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public. It is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. Public is present tonight. Public comment cards are located on the table outside the boardroom. Please complete and return to Erica Dell to help expedite your comment. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. All members of the committee are present again. And item two on the agenda is for public comments. Do we have members of the public that may comment on items within the subject matter of jurisdiction of the agency or that are not on the agenda at this time? We ask that the members of the public wishing to comment on items that are listed on this agenda do so at the time each item is considered. Are there any public comments on items not covered in the agenda?
Yes, we have public comment. Cam Niltemeyer, you may approach the podium. You have 3 minutes.
Cam Niltemeyer, as you probably know, I've been following this water company for years. And I think that we're about at our worst right now. And then I got in here tonight and found out that not only are we discussing this, we're adding this. That's the type of thing you're giving to the public if they even dare show up for your meetings. If I'm angry, yes, I am. I have been watching you for a long time, and it just seems it keeps going like this. And only thing you're good at is spending money as much as you can into the right pockets. And it seems to me that somewhere along this line, we have to stop you. And right now you have, what, four of you here? That shouldn't be too hard a thing to take under consideration. Because your position on coming here and having a public meeting is to serve the public. But you do little of that anyway. But now you're making the meetings very hard for anybody want to come and then find out they have this added on to it. plus there being so many items in here that really need discussion. And I don't know how to put in my disgust with what I've been seeing going on. I don't know what you think you're gaining. I certainly haven't seen anything where this water company has gained anything at all. But tonight is a pure sign of what you're hoping to do and add some little things in there so the public won't even know about it. And they won't. There's nobody here that's going to report this. But I just think there have to be better people that we can get to be on a water board to serve the community. Not coming up with your wonderful creative ideas, which just adds another person to be controlling what you should be controlling.
Thank you so much for your comments.
Any other public comment?
No other comments at this time.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
You may, Director Colley.
So have we added anything to the agenda? Are we going to discuss anything tonight that was not on the agenda? I mean, there was allusions to some sort of...
I believe that was for a revision.
So,
that publication that's posted in at everybody's spot is simply the revised ACFR that was posted to the website last week as well as emailed out.
Okay.
It's just a revision. It's just the hard copy revision.
But the ACFR is in the agenda.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. I want to make sure we're not actually trying to deceive the public in some way.
Thank you.
Right. That was item number two. Now we can move on to item number three. Item three is the, actually, we're going to talk about this report now. Recommend receiving and filing the SCV Water Annual Comprehensive Financial Report. ACFR, as somebody just called it, ACFR. Ended year ending June 30th, 2023. Rochelle Patterson, please.
So I'm going to introduce the senior manager from Lansdell and Lungard. They're the agency's auditors. Christian Towns will be presenting the ACFR to the committee tonight.
Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. And then I believe Erica has a PowerPoint as well that she's going to share. Just want to make sure that gets up and presented.
Yes, we have it ready to go.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so I'm Christian Towns. I'm the senior manager that was just introduced with LSL. And as part of the LSL team, we'd like to thank Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency Board for having us present tonight and the accounting and finance team, particularly Amy Eger, that we work with primarily, and Rochelle Patterson for such a smooth audit this year. We can go ahead and go to the next slide, please. This is your primary team that worked on the audit this year. We have Brandon Young is the partner, myself, the senior manager, and then Jamie Lambert, the manager. He did a lot of the communication day-to-day activities with the team at Santa Clarita. Next slide, please. The scope of our audit included the financial statement audit for the year ended June 30th, 2023, in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards and government auditing standards. We additionally note that the generally accepted auditing standards is the baseline for which audits are performed, and government auditing standards is the higher level audit, which is what we performed over Santa Clarita, which focuses as well on internal controls. This financial statement audit also included the Upper Santa Clara Valley, Devil's Den Water District, and Groundwater Sustainability Agency. And then additionally, we performed an evaluation of the appropriations limit worksheets, the GAN limit as it's well known, for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2023, which is an agreed upon procedure There is no exceptions noted as a result of our procedures. Next slide, please. The scope of the engagement included interim fieldwork that was performed early May. We examined internal controls, processes, and procedures. We provided feedback to management along any of those procedures that we performed. And we performed our audit risk assessment to sufficiently plan our audit approach. And then we planned our year-end audit procedures using such risks that we had evaluated. Our year-end fieldwork was performed in early October. We detailed testing of account balances and transactions. We included substantiation of those transactions and analytic procedures. We did compliance testing with laws, regulations, grant agreements, and contracts. And that's part of your higher level government auditing standards audit. And then we also performed other procedures as deemed necessary to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence to issue our opinion. Results of our audit, we did issue an unmodified auditor's opinion, which is the best opinion that you can receive on the financial statements. Overall, that means the financial statements are accurate and reliable with no material misstatements as of June 30th, 2023. We issued our report on internal control and compliance, noting no significant deficiencies or material weakness in internal controls and no non-compliance matters with laws, regulations, and grants. We identified no material audit adjustments, no areas of going concern doubts. We identified no fraud, waste, or abuse during the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2023 audit. We had no disagreements with management about any applications of accounting principles, no difficulties conducting our audits, and we determined that all estimates used by management in preparing the financial statements were considered reasonable. Significant changes from the prior year. During the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2023, Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency was required to adopt a new accounting principle related to the accounting for subscription-based information technology arrangements, GASB 96. This was no small feat, so it took a lot of extra time from the accounting finance group to get that together. GASB 96 requires that a subscription asset and subscription liability are recognized. This resulted an overall subscription asset on the financial statements in the amount of $1,103,000, $103,030. Oh my gosh, I'm out of practice for these big numbers. About $1.1 million at June 30th, 2023, and a subscription liability in the amount of $613,000 at June 30th, 2023. There's additional notes to this information within your footnotes in note 7. So it'll give you a little bit more of a breakdown and additional detail. Some financial highlights. Your net position increased by $20.9 million during the year to $735.6 million. Your unrestricted net position represented about 119% of operating expenses and 19.9% of total net position. That's really your available funds that aren't restricted for other purposes. Capital assets increased $7.9 million, or about 2.3% from the prior year. Your long-term debts decreased $6.4 million, or 1.9% from the prior year. Your net pension liability increased about $13.7 million from the prior year and is 78.5% funded. And then the OPEB liability decreased $2.8 million from the prior year and is 90.2% funded. For both the net pension liability and the OPEB liability, those are actuarial driven. So those can see significant swings from one year to the next based on actuary valuations. Okay, those are the overall highlights. Does anybody have any questions?
With that, I guess that's the end of the presentation. Yes. Okay. Do we have any public comment?
No public comments at this time.
Questions from the board? Director Cawley.
Not directly related, but years ago, the CLWA used to occasionally ask for specific audits of like subsets of the auditor on some years, and we haven't done that in a while. I guess I'm asking the auditor, is there anything that you think we might benefit, any risk areas that we might consider auditing in future years, rather than just the general audit that we do year after year?
I think that can depend on many factors. So year over year, we focus more on an audit risk level, which does incorporate details within specific accounts and account groupings. But I would say at the board level, if there were ever an area that you wanted to be dug into further, that might not always be the same exact area that is dug into further as part of the audit. So I think it would be best to bring up those concerns in a year that you might have, or just areas that you think haven't been looked into in depth in maybe a few years that you would rather bring up some kind of more specific audit over certain transactions, certain groups of activity or funding. That would be more than happy to work on an arrangement for, if that helps answer your question.
All right. Nothing specific comes to mind, however, apparently.
No, nothing specific at this time.
Vice President Gutzeit.
I have a question for Ms. Patterson. What year did we change audit teams? Is this a relatively new?
This is the fourth year for LSL, and we have an option for the fifth year. So we'll be using LSL next year, and then we'll go out to RFP.
Okay. Thank you, and congratulations on it. Sounds like a great audit process this year. So congratulations to everyone on the team.
Director Almatrage.
Thank you. Just want to say thank you for your presentation, Ms. Towns, and thank you for your team for the report. I spent a lot of time over the weekend trying to understand all the figures, and my head was spinning after a while.
It can be a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. It is a lot. So thank you for your presentation in summarizing kind of all that for us. And I agree, it's reassuring to hear that your findings are that it seems that all of the accounting are in line with standards and expectations. So thank you for that. And then I just have one comment and one question, I think, for Ms. Patterson. My comment for the org chart, and this is kind of just in general, I feel like anytime we have an org chart, I feel like we should always put the public on top, even above the board of directors. I've seen it in another document, and I appreciated it in that. And I just think it just needs to be consistently done in all the org charts. And then my other question is just, I was interested in the section that showed all the different lease agreements, particularly for all of the towers. And I was trying to figure out why they're all different. That's my only question.
Because they come in at different times and with different amounts, and they also have different escalators. So at any time, there could be annually a different amount for each annual lease.
Thank you.
The only question I have, not a question, it was really more of a comment. The lease assets, this is the first time I've seen that. Of course, you explained it well in the CAFR, why you're putting those in. Those lease assets are only the leases that the agency is having with the cell towers, or are there other ones?
They're both. So most of them are the leases. The money is coming into us, but there are a couple we lease modulars. Anything that we lease can also be part of this standard.
Okay. That's what I thought too. Okay. That's a clarification. And with that, is it the pleasure of the committee to go ahead and recommend the board of directors receive and file this the water annual comprehensive financial report for the period of July 2022 to 23 June? Is that?
I think we ought to put it on the regular agenda and have a 2-hour discussion of it.
I'm not that sure. What is the previous?
Previous, yeah. It was just put on consent after it's gone through committee, yeah. But the last couple of years we've presented it to the board. Amy presented it last year, and just the simple format with just a couple pie charts and graphs. So if that's what the board would want.
And we can do that. Director Colley is in a good mood tonight. Oh, okay. Okay, we'll move on now to item number 4.
Okay. And before we move on, I just want to, thank Amy for all of her work, hours and hours and hours on the audit, and her team worked really hard on this. And it was a team effort with the intro section, the stat section, which Doreen worked on. So It was definitely a team effort, but it's a big undertaking. Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Uh-huh. It's always a Christmas present to be done with. with that, we'll move on to item number four, and that will be presented by Ms. Patterson, but it's a recommend approval of the HCM implementation of the contract with APPS Associates. Michelle.
Yes. So we heard this last month, and we took note of the questions, and we're bringing it back. We did have legal counsel review the scope of work. They made a couple recommended changes and some that Director Colley had recognized, and those have all been added to the scope of work and accepted. And we've also worked on the agreement, the professional services agreement, and legal has also approved that contract. So those were a couple things that were asked last month before it came back. And I just want to let you know that legal has reviewed both of those documents. So I'll try to not be too repetitive from last month, but just that the agency prides itself on being the best in class agency. And yet many of our HR functions, we are still using a lot of manual processes. This is one part of the agency where we haven't automated, we haven't changed, we're still using the same processes we did pre-merger, post-merger. It hasn't really changed. As we grow, we need to automate, and our manual processes are prone to risk. And this is also the second phase of the Oracle implementation. Next slide. So the Oracle implementation project, the first one part was phase one, and that included the ERP, the EPM, that's the finance portion, and the budgeting and procurement. And then they implemented what was called HCM Lite. It is part of the HCM, but it's very minimal, and it needed to be implemented in order for procurement to be able to put in the proper approval flows for POs and contracts. But that's the only thing that was implemented on the HCM side. We always knew that we wanted to do phase two, but just didn't have the resources at that time. We had very limited staff, and we just knew that we couldn't take on both at the same time, and knew that we would be adding phase two at some point. We did think it was going to be a year ago, but we're a little bit late, but we are ready to go. In phase one, that implementation was completed by MTech, and MTech earlier this year was acquired by APPS Associates. But we have all of our same resources that we had at MTech that knows our system very well, along with many more that in the public sector that can help us out with the core HCM. Next slide. Some of our current challenges and our inefficiencies are our recruitment. It's a manual workflow. And we talk about recruitment, the pre-hire background screening and onboarding, all of those things. We should be able to have one system that puts a job out for recruitment, accepts applications. We accept the candidate. There's a letter that goes out to the candidate, comes back. All of that information on the application then puts into the pre-hire. And then we start onboarding. Well, everything is manual. So all of those are tracked manual. There's three different systems for the pre-hire background screening and three different systems for onboarding. So we're talking about taking the same information and putting it in three different times. Our performance and probation reviews, right now we track it in Excel, and our performance review is on Excel. And employees have to, if they don't keep a copy of it, they have to go to HR every year and ask for a copy if they want one. Or managers have to go for a copy. There isn't any way that there isn't a self-service where employees can go and look at anything that they have in their employee file. Our regulatory reports are mostly manual. Some of the reports come out of paychecks, but some of the reports are just held in a spreadsheet. So we have to compile those in order to do those regulatory reports. So as I said, there's no self-service, so employees can't go in and check their pay. They can't check their benefits, nor any of the forms that they have in their file. And then just the many, many manual processes. So we take our paper forms, we scan them, we e-file them, then we put them in the physical file. We have broken workflows and just, you know, no linkage in between any of these HR functions. Next slide. So for the project's value, we believe there's some time savings through automation. The robust analytics that the HCM has, it will bring in real time and we can consolidate data across all of our modules, including the ones in phase one, the ERP, the procurement and budgeting side. And for streamlining benefits for HR and for employees, right now there isn't a linkage between our system and CalPERS. So we will now have a link in between our system and CalPERS. So somebody can go and during open enrollment change their benefit package and it will come back to the agency in Oracle. So we don't have to go back through and manually enter it into our system. And for the regulatory compliance, it'll be seamless reporting. All the demographics, everything will already be in the system. Better employee experience of just all the, you know, the employees will be able to see all their documents and make changes. And the biggest thing that we found is the single source of truth. It's you go one place to find the information. We hate to have to go to two different places and the information be different. So it's nice to have one single source of truth to go to. Next slide. So our collaboration with APPS Associates, our partnership, we started in 2020 when we implemented the first phase of Oracle. They do have proven industry expertise. The biggest thing is their deep understanding of SCV water systems. They help build Oracle. It's not an out of the box. There are many customizations that we had to do for what we do. We had told them what we needed and they built it for us. It's not something that's just out of the box. They were able to do the HCM in a phased approach to meet our workflow and our resource limitations. And they do have resource excellence when we talk about, it's different when we did years ago, some of these demos and we talk about, you know, CalPERS and PEPRA and Classic. And a lot of those vendors didn't know what that was. APPS Associates did because they have clients in the public sector. So they know what CalPERS is. And so that's just an added benefit. Next slide. So when we're looking at our project stage timeline, the first portion is the core HCM that's getting all of the employees in with all of our demographics. That's the talent management, that's the recruitment and onboarding, benefits, and that's about an 18-week implementation, and they give us 4 weeks of post-go-live support, and that can start in January, anywhere between January and hopefully complete by June of 2024. And then the next two can work concurrently because they're two different departments. So our payroll, time and labor, and absence management, that is on the payroll side in accounting, and the recruiting and journeys is in the HR department on that side, so they can work concurrently. Although payroll is about a 30-week timeframe, because we're talking about payroll and time and labor, so that's our time card system that's paying our employees and making sure we get all of those rules correct. And then the recruiting and journeys is about 18 weeks with 4 weeks post go live. And that can start also in July and go through December. Next slide. We were asked last month about like the project value. And we did some asking and it's really hard for staff to anticipate what the cost savings will be with implementing some type of automation. We know there will be because there was when we implemented The first phase of Oracle, we were able to eliminate a lot of those manual processes. But when we put, it's hard to just put that dollar to it. I mean, we anticipate potentially, you know, with automation of maybe not having to hire another HR staff as we grow for a little bit. We know we'll be saving $7,000 a year because we could cancel our third-party recruiting software. So that's a direct savings. We reached out, and Oracle has a data analytic calculator that could estimate some potential savings. They take in many factors, like including number of employees, kind of your turnover rate. And that three-year project benefit was $143,000. So it is showing some savings. We do believe we'll have, you know, improved productivity with just reporting and that efficiency. They also had put out, and that's what this slide is, this project value. They have a realization report where they do customer surveys of all of their customers, and some of the things that came out that 62% improved in reporting productivity, 29% reduced legacy system cost, and 11% improved workforce efficiency, and that reduced the number of FTEs. So that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, we're looking at. We're hoping that by eliminating some of those manual processes, we could defer or delay, you know, any HR new hires to help support our staff. Next slide. So on the financial considerations, there the three phases there, one, two, or three. The apps associates cost is $1.79 million. They offer also a change management, will help us writing those SOPs going forward, and they will help train our groups so we have better change management. We failed slightly when we did the first implementation and thought we could do it ourselves, and we did, but it was clunky. So we really would like to take advantage of the change management that they are offering. And then we're anticipating one or two limited duration employees just to backfill the project manager and the subject matter expert, because they'll be about 80% of their time will be focused on the HCM project, and we'll have to backfill some to do their work, and that's the limited duration employees. There's also a little bit in additional licensing for a couple of the modules for HCM. So next slide. So the recommendation is that Finance Administration Committee recommends that the Board of Directors approve the HCM implementation project cost of $2.2 million and authorize a general manager to enter into a contract with Apps Associates for a fixed contract cost of $1,791,460. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Is there any public comment?
No public comment.
Thank you. Directors? I pick Director Armitage first.
I don't have questions, but I just want to say I appreciate you coming back with the additional information. And I know it was hard to put a dollar amount, but further explaining how you think this will benefit your department and the staff. So thank you for that.
Vice President Gutzeit.
You mentioned in here cancellation of the recruiting third-party software. Is this going to affect anything else like paychecks?
So we may save a little bit with paychecks, but we'll still have paychecks mostly just to do the quarterly and annual filing as well as the W-2s.
Okay. So it... Is there anything else that we'll have to keep that this doesn't do that you're aware of?
No, I think it's we can eliminate any of the third-party softwares that we were using, and the biggest one was the $7,000 for the NeoGov, which is the third-party recruiting. But and like I said, we may save a little bit in paychecks because we're not actually doing the time and labor in paychecks. We're just having them do the reporting.
Okay. Thank
Director Cawley.
So I of course still stumble over the 2 million plus. We are told often that something is going to introduce efficiencies and things will be easier on staff, and we will, you know, staff will be more productive or whatever. And today we're told that maybe we might save on some future time by maybe delaying the hiring of somebody. You understand, of course, that that's not much of a savings that I can understand. I understand that maybe there's some staff members that don't like entering things into three different places. That may be tedious, it may be unpleasant. But oftentimes people are paid to do things which are tedious or unpleasant, and it's kind of the nature of work. I would suspect that there are many jobs that involve things that people would not do recreationally if they had the choice. But we hire them to do these things, and they do, and they do it well, apparently. This, you know, computer software solutions are a constantly moving target. And so today's state-of-the-art, oh my God, fix is pretty much taking over the oh my God, state-of-the-art fix of 10 years ago. And so the systems that you're right now considering to replace are, you know, were, when they're implemented, they cost us something, and they were considered to be the best available, probably. And so I'm really having difficulty figuring out how to value $2.2 million where we really haven't been given much in the way of what will be better. I think there's some value in employees being able to look up on them for themselves. That's valuable. Is it worth $2 million? Probably not. Is a potential in some future time to maybe not hire an individual worth something? Yeah, but probably not worth $2 million. I really struggle with just spending money on something where the value is not more concrete, so to speak. So I do appreciate, as others have suggested, the going back and trying to answer the questions, and I appreciate the improvements. But I still have great difficulty on $2.2 million for this project.
Director, Vice President Gutzeit.
Thank you. I will say, you know, I wasn't here last time, but I did talk to Ms. Patterson about, you know, the hours going into this project and the amount of time that it would take to implement, which I understand is a lot of the $2 million cost. I understand the issue with state-of-the-art systems becoming obsolete. But one of the reasons I've seen a lot of systems implemented that just companies spend money on, and I'm talking about compliance management systems, and companies spend a lot of money on them. They do training, all this stuff, and they are never well received. And then it goes away. And then there's another thing 10 years later when the management comes. a different management comes along and says, we're going to do it differently. And here's the new system. But I think putting in the hours and the time of these people to work on it and customize it to our needs is probably what would distinguish this from that. And I also see the value in not running multiple Excel spreadsheets. I just think for the people we have, they probably have other things to do than entering data on an Excel sheet if it can be automated. I mean, just as far as their job satisfaction level and the ability to do other things that maybe would avoid hiring a consultant or put them on another project. I think when we're essentially being human calculators, if there's another option, I would explore that. So I'm in support of this.
Thank you. Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thanks. So just as I'm listening to the conversation, just a couple follow-up comments or questions. I mean, so it is a large amount. And I think that's the sticky point for you and for, I think, all of us. It kind of gives you pause, right? But I do imagine that this is the direction that most agencies are going in for work efficiency purposes, if they have the budget to do so, right? And, you know, it's been mentioned that this is a multi-phase project. And I imagine that the agency was beginning to think about this before I even came on, right? Like, mm-hmm. So this has been in the works for many years. And so I just wanted to verify that these costs were anticipated and budgeted for. Is that correct?
Yes, we did budget for them and we knew this project was coming. So it was included in the budget.
Okay. And was there discussion at previous years kind of about how this was going to play out over time?
Well, we did, but it was, we were looking at implementation a year ago and we weren't ready for it yet. And so we haven't discussed it for a year.
Okay. And then also since we're going with a vendor, because we're familiar to them and they're familiar to us and we have that working relationship with them. I guess the only question I have around that is, we didn't do like a cost comparison because of that, right? But do we have a sense if that figure is not outrageous, is not inflated improperly?
No, I don't believe so. When we take the number of hours that they're going to be working to implement, it seems pretty low. We are also receiving a credit just from already being a customer because they do know that they do know our systems, even though it is a new implementation, but they are familiar with the agency and how we work. And I don't know to add to Director Pauline, and it may not add anything at all, but Oracle is Oracle. And when we implemented the first phase, we didn't do the on-premise, so which phases out. We did do the cloud version, and that does get updated every quarter. So I'm hoping it doesn't like phase out, that it continues in the cloud. That's like the new thing, and we went with a new thing. Oracle is a tier one company. They're used by, Fortune 500 companies. It's big. It's bigger than we would probably ever need, but it's there and can be expanded and it will work for us into the future. I'm not going to guarantee that 10 years from now, something better doesn't come along and you blame me for the implementation, but we did try to plan so we weren't pigeonholed into like an on-premise version that was going to be, not supported at some point.
Okay. That's all I had. Thank you.
The HR function of this agency has become more and more of a complicated because of the rules of the state of California, and of course it's being a public agency, you have to comply by certain regulations, etc. The HCM is always reacting to those regulations, and usually it comes down to, as what the these statistics are of the employee group, and if they're being treated fairly with within the laws of the state of California. So I am, aghast about the price too, but this is software. I just remember that we didn't spend this much on our customer service programming back in the day, but now those kind of costs have come up because of the intensity of the software and how you input it. I am in favor of it only because of the idea that the staff is recommending it, and I support the staff and their desire to achieve the best service they can for the employees here. So with that, I would like to take this to the board as a full discussion with the board.
Mm-hmm. I'll make one kind of a comment that I don't think is redundant to my others, and that is that having something in the budget isn't free money. It's still money, and we were told not too long ago that because we've decided not to do a rate study in the shorter term, that we're going to be faced with even larger financial challenges in the not so distant future. So I think it's important for us to try our best to conserve our resources, our money, and as much as we can. And I just, something being in the budget is not an argument that I think that we ought to credit to say that's a reason to spend money. So just want to make that point. And obviously I would have preferred that we send this back to try to find less expensive solutions.
Vice President Cusack.
Sorry, I had it left on. When it comes to the full board, can you provide some more detail on the cost? Is that possible? I know you said some of it's proprietary, but some feel for hours and like number of people on the project, because I think that might help people understand where the large dollar amount's coming from.
I'll ask the consultant if they're willing to allow me to provide that.
Yeah, I think it would help, because, if we know that 15 people are spending 400 hours each on this, that is understandable, or one person spending 40 hours on it is, obviously different. Mm-hmm. So, if it's workload, if it's fees, if it, the software package, what's driving the cost? A little more detail, I think, would be helpful when it comes to the whole board.
Any more comments from the board members? Hearing none, we'll move on to item number 5. Recommend approval to direct a general manager to enter into a contract with Planet Bids. Ms. Patterson, please.
Yes. As you may know, SCV Water relies on Planet Bids. It's a web-based bid management software where we can post requests for information, requests for proposals, requests for quotes in order to reach a large database of suppliers and contractors. This software has been used since the creation of SCV Water and even prior by the legacy CLWA and Santa Clarita divisions. It enables efficient posting and monitoring and awarding of contracts, ensuring compliance with governmental requirements and the agency's purchasing policy that requires us to go out for bid and also post. Planet Bids is extremely utilized across SCV Water, most of their departments. Engineering uses it probably daily, if not many times a day. procurement, finance, IT, water resources, operations, conservation, treatment. The current five-year contract that we have with Planet Bids signed in 2018 for $341,635 is set to expire. Renewal options include a year-to-year purchase with a 5-year or 5% yearly increase, or there is a 3-year agreement that increases 3% annually, or a 5-year agreement with no increase the first 2 years. The first 3 years, followed by a 3% increase in 3 and 4. The total increase from the last 5-year agreement to the current proposed 5-year agreement is $3,639. So we were asking that the Finance Administration Committee recommends that the Board of Directors authorize the General Manager to enter a 5-year contract for a total amount of $345,274. That concludes my report.
Thank you. Any public comments?
No public comments.
Thank you. With that, any comments from the board? Questions from the board? Well, no? Yes? Director Crowley, go ahead.
I just make a comment. I very well understand the value of Planet Bids. Perhaps that's why I'm going to be more supportive, because I understand it better. And certainly, I you know, this is one of the things that this board is asking different contracts at different times. If we commit ourselves to something a little longer term, can we save money? And here we have exactly what we've asked for. So I think that makes sense. I think it pretty much ought to just go on consent.
Right.
So I'm in favor. Mm-hmm.
Just one question. Is this billed on a yearly basis or on a...
It's an annual basis.
Annual basis. And is there any extra for how many bids we try to put through it?
No, you pay by user, so it doesn't matter how much we use it.
That's right. I remember that now. All right. With that, we'll move this to the consent item. When appropriate. All right, item number 6 is review facility capacity fee, revenues, and study components. And Rochelle, please start out.
Okay, as I also mentioned last month, I'm assuming this will be discussion one of many, but at least we're teeing off the topic, and as we get questions or need more details, we will come back for another discussion, because I know we can't answer everything tonight, but this is just a good place to start to get us going into understanding what the facility capacity fees are. Next slide. So in the agenda, what is a facility capacity fee? We were asked what the difference between a facility capacity fee and a retail capacity fee was, so I'll try to explain that. Overview of prior and current studies, our current FCF challenges, an analysis of our FCF revenues, and potential next steps that we can talk about. Next slide. So what is a facility capacity fee? And we're talking, this is the regional facility capacity fee. We're not talking about the retail piece right now. It's just the retail used to be the CLWA facility capacity fee. It's dubbed the regional capacity fee. Any new prior and new projects to support growth are billed 70% for current users, 30% for future users. And that was actually determined in 2017 when they did the facility capacity fee study, knowing that our service area was about 70% built out. So any Any new projects that had that growth component in there would be billed at 30% for future users. It covers the portion of the project cost to upgrade, expand, providing additional water system capacity. So not replacing what we have, but providing something and expanding for future growth. The fee that was developed under Castaic Lake Water Agency addresses the regional water treatment, distribution projects, emergency storage, water banking, water rights acquisition, water supply projects, and other projects, including the development of recycled water systems. Some of the projects, they supply water to multiple entities, typically at a larger scale, through centralized transmission and distribution. As I said, water supply banking, the recycled water backbone system, treatment plant expansion, regional storage, which is the tanks, water tanks, the storage, and pipeline. Next slide. Okay, this was our very gross interpretation of the difference between regional and retail capacity fees. And this came from most of it, engineering's presentation from the Water Academy. So some people may be familiar, but we kind of added a few things. So just for me visually, I just draw a line. I'm like, okay, these are the big projects. These are all state water projects. This is something big. And then you draw the line to the retail capacity fees, and the retail is to support the retail developments. Like, you know, it's the smaller pump stations, the wells, the storage tanks that serve those retail customers. So for the regional capacity fees, we have the surface water treatment plants, right? Those aren't on the retail side. Retail doesn't build those, right? It comes from the regional capacity fee. So surface water treatment plants, the regional storage, the large storage, and includes the clear wells that are out here, the big, you know, storage here. There's the transmission piping, which is usually larger in size. It's bringing more water over to the retail side. We have dry year reliability wells, recycled water backbone system, and both sides have pump stations because you have to pump the water to locations. So we know that the retail, we have groundwater, right? So that's what the retail does. It pumps the groundwater. It needs the facilities to pump the groundwater, but it doesn't serve all of our customers, right? The other part comes from the regional side, which is the surface water. So the regional side builds everything that they need to get the water, treat the water, and then it goes through a pump station that will deliver the water to on the retail side, and they'll blend it, kind of where the arrows are, with our well water and the surface water. It goes up to the retail storage tanks, and some of them are gravity fed down to homes, and some of them need to be pumped based on their elevation, and that includes the meters and the hydrants and all the laterals, everything that goes to the home. So it's pretty much everything that when a developer comes in and they need water for a, say, just this circle of homes right here, what facilities do you need to get water there? Do you need a tank? Do you need a booster station because you need to get water up there? That's all on the retail side. So the retail, remember, we used to be separate. So the retail had to build their own facilities in order for the developers to connect. Now the developers are paying their own, but at that time, the divisions themselves were paying. They were building the storage tanks. They were drilling the wells. And then so any new developer came in needed to buy into that capacity or future expansion. And on the regional side, the same thing. They also need to expand, right? We have more demand. So we need to expand the treatment plant to get more of that water from the left side over to the right side. Did that help? Did I get it right? Okay. I guess.
Can we let the public comment at this point and then we'll have an interactive discussion? Would that work?
Okay. I can.
Or you can save it for the end. I don't have many slides, so we can, if you can remember, we can save it to the end. That's okay. 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 Okay, let's go to the next slide. Okay, so prior and current studies. So in 2017, prior to SCV Water, the facility capacity fee model was totally changed. It used to be prior to 2017, if you had a connection, I know Director Gutzeit, you bring this up all the time, the connections were based on capacity. So how much demand somebody was, whether how many faucets, how many toilets, how many square feet, it was this really complex calculation to determine the fee that they were going to pay. There was also 10 water service areas. So in 2017, one of the things that was changed was to bring it into a meter equivalent, which was very similar to what the retail divisions did. They charged based on meter size or service size. So that was changed. They reduced from 10 water service areas to 4. And then they also modified their methodology. The calculation of the interfund loan was eliminated so everyone could understand what was in the capacity fees. They streamlined the application process. They better aligned it like retail with the meter size. And then in 2018, there was a small amendment. It was added to do a prorated adjustment for meter connections that were smaller than 1 inch, because at that time, the meter connection was set at 1 inch. Well, we also have a 3/4 inch and a 5/8. So there we added a 3/4 inch and a 5/8 capacity fee charge. And then in 2019, we updated the capacity fees. It was based on incremental cost approach. The fee calculation was primarily based on the number of EMUs that was determined we would have at build out using the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan. In 2019, that's the best data that we had. It applied future interest rates to project financing and projected projects that we would need at build out. And looking back, it was probably maybe, as we know, our projects are changing all the time. But, you know, at that time in 2019, those were the projects that we said needed to be built, and 30% for growth were charged in the capacity fees. And then the fees are escalated annually based on the ENR index, about 3% per year. Next slide. Current challenges when we talk about, you know, how much do we, based on our model in the 2019 facility capacity fee study and how our revenues are coming in and how many connections are coming in, it's that incremental cost approach. We just have to put an assumption to it, and we know what build out is. And there was a lot of modeling to say what percentage would it take per year to get to that build out. And so there is a percentage every year of how many connections that we think we are going to add. Now there's some uncertainty there too, because in any given year, we're not sure which water service area they're going to go in, and they're different fees. So, you know, there's, you know, just like with any kind of studies or analysis, it's assumption based. At that time, we didn't know about delays in new development because of COVID. You know, things could have been things were kind of moving along. And then we had some COVID challenges. The developers stopped working, you know, because of COVID. They couldn't get the materials that they needed to build their homes. And then we have this rising interest rates, and, you know, developers aren't building as much and as fast because homes aren't selling as fast because of the high interest rates. Next slide. Now, I know this is small, but it's in your packet. So this is the attachment one. So this is out through build out. It's every year from 2021 when the facility capacity fees started fiscal year down to 2051. And the growth in that study said that we would have a growth projected new connections of 31,230 out until 2051, 30 years. So how, you know, in doing some analysis, like I said, we used a lot of modeling. How can we determine when those new connections are going to come in? And it was a little higher in the, you know, the first few years, and it got slower and slower as the service area started to build out. And we can see that in the first year, we actually had projected 1,104 connections, but we actually received 1,254 connections, but yet our revenue was less than what we thought it was going to be, because the revenue that we collected could have been in different meter sizes than was assumed. It could have been in a different WASA than we assumed. Even though there were more connections, there was less revenues. And then we can see in 2022, the effects of COVID, 2023, the effect of inflation and interest rates, where we had received, you know, we got 948 connections and 314 out of the 1,096. Next slide. So next steps. So there's no recovery of uncollected revenue or accumulated interest charges that are allowed to be put back in to our next study. We can't charge future developers. We have to charge them what their cost of service is. We can't charge them for, you know, costs that should have been collected years ago, because then their costs would be inflated. It's not their share of the system. Talk to legal, we talk to a ratepayer advocate, because they do these types of studies too. We're like, well, how can we potentially in future studies kind of get around the timing issues? So if we build something and the connections haven't come in yet, how can we try to receive some, generate some revenue without adding that lost revenue to a future connection fee? Well, it was suggested that we incorporate a buy-in fee. So if we are adding, if we're building facilities, it goes into our fixed asset report, we can add a buy-in component to the fee to try to generate some of that, you know, recover some of those funds that we hadn't collected, because we pre-built the system. So they're buying into that capacity. And we're still waiting on the completion of the agency-wide master plan, where we're potentially looking to combine the regional and retail capacity fees. There's complexities there, but looking at maybe one fee, and then we could for sure have a expansion fee that would for that 30% of expansion that we still have for growth, and then add a buy-in fee for those facilities that the agency is building where developers haven't connected yet. So that's kind of where we are with our revenues, some potential solutions, and now I'll open it up to questions.
Do we have any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you, Rochelle. Good job.
I got my pen ready.
Vice President Gusa, you can start first.
Okay. I was staring at the slide with the tanks on it, because it's the same picture, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the break? I mean, just out of curiosity, I mean, and I was the one that asked for pictures, but what's the distinction between a regional storage and a retail storage? Is there a threshold where it would be on one side of the line or the other?
So the regional storage is surface water, right? So that's where the state water we get from the state water project comes through, we treat it here, it gets pumped up to the storage tanks. But they're big, 8 million gallons.
Yeah,
Courtney.
So they are different tanks. Okay, even though it's the same picture, that's what was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the same picture, you're just grabbing a picture of storage reservoirs in general. Okay. And this was for, again, the Water Academy. So it was a simplified version. There, specifically for this, your regional capacity fee and your reservoirs are connected to the regional system, which used to be separate from all of the other agency systems. What we call now our transmission, our primary transmission system that goes through. In general, they are larger in nature, but it is a defined system separate from the regional systems of the former package agencies or right. retail agencies.
Okay.
So the emergency storage, as you would, is proposed to connect to that transmission and is therefore viewed as a regional system.
Okay. That was really helpful because, I mean, here's just a general thought at this point. I still think this is very wordy. I actually like the way you said it better. If we keep two fees, and not to harp on pictures, but you know, if there's a diagram and these things on this system, on the transmission system are considered regional, and then these things on these other systems are considered retail, I think that would be clear in my mind. But I'm also wondering, and you don't have to tell me now, but would it make sense? Do we still need all the WASAs? Do we need two fees? Can we just go with one fee and get rid of the WASAs? And I'm just curious.
Those are questions we really probably should go a little bit deeper in a separate board presentation. And it really has to do representation across the state. I think a lot of other agencies have a supplier. Using my own experience from San Diego, they have County Water Authority, which has a separate fee from the retail agencies who also collect a fee. If you combine them and create fee, one fee, you may look like you have the highest fee in the state. If you keep them rational with how other agencies are doing it, where they pay a wholesaler to deliver water and then they have the retail fee, then you have a apples to apples comparison. That comparison does come out statewide each year. So that is a consideration. We're one agency. The simpler process is to use one fee. So that would be something that definitely the board can provide direction and we can give examples of in future presentation.
And is it feasible to get rid of the WASA? It just seems like we're doing a lot of calculating. Can you get rid of the WASAs or would that not work for a certain reason?
I actually don't know that answer. We would have to look into
that. It's separated by area. So you have your East End WASA. You have one just for Whitaker Burmite.
Yeah.
And then you have your West End, which is just New Home Ranch. And there's a different, there's recycled water taken out of your New Hall Ranch WASA. So they all have a little bit different component.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, if we could look at that or, well, sure, if you want to help with that specifically.
Yeah, I the Whitaker Burmite WASA was specifically established so that we could recover costs specific to that challenged area. Now, I have heard grumblings elsewhere that maybe there's legal issues with being able to collect that, but that was certainly the intent when it was created, is to essentially, in fairness, not put future costs of treating the pollution that's coming off of that land onto everyone in the agency, you know, everyone that in the agency at the time, rather than essentially encumber that land with higher fees, so that any future buyer of that land or any future user of that land would pay for the cost of the pollution that was created by the idea, I think, was that if you buy anything, you are buying the benefits and the problems of the past owner of that thing. So if you buy a car and it's not been well maintained, I don't need to pay for the repair of that car. You bought it. It's your problem. And that was, I think, the essential idea of creating that WASA back then. In fairness to everybody else in the valley, to encumber that land with the potential higher costs.
Well, I understand from the retail side, we have to charge people the cost of service. I think, so arguing against myself, I can see where we would need WASAs. If it was a very hilly area, difficult to serve, it's going to cost more to get water to them. So I can see where that might make sense, infill versus, you know, ridgetop or... I could see where we need WASAs. I don't know the history of the Whitaker Burmite thing, but I don't think we should be penalizing landowners in excess of the cost of service to punish them for polluting the land, because they paid for the cleanup. So if there's going to be houses up there, those homeowners and builders of on that land should pay to get water there. They shouldn't be also paying for the cleanup because the polluter already paid in the settlement. Is that what you were trying to say?
Well, I would disagree. They've already paid for the cleanup. They've paid for part of the cleanup. That'd be true. But we are going to be paying for many decades into the future to treat the pollution that's coming off of that land. And, you know, the land was... some of it was dug up and treated, and there's all kinds of things that got done that were very expensive, but they were not 100% effective by any means. And so we will be treating that water that underlies those homes. Basically, you know, you could view it as we're taking the water, their groundwater, which is flowing into our wells and polluted, and now we treat it and send it back to them. And that costs us more money than it does, say, on the east end where the Whitaker pollution doesn't exist. So if you take folks in deep and canyon country and force them to pay for the treatment of the pollution that's coming off the land on the central or west end of the valley, I think there's a serious fairness issue there. And that was the thinking at the time, that the Whitaker Burmite landowners would suffer from the pollution that we now have to clean up. And I would point out that it doesn't necessarily punish the homeowner of that land, because presumably if we are going to charge more to serve a house on that land, it devalues that land, and the homeowner would presumably get a lower price on the home because they're going to be paying more for water. That's kind of, you know, this is an economic issue that's not unusual.
Okay, well, we can have probably we probably need a separate session on WASAs. But I think in general, simplifying it would be better. I understand the comment about cost compare. I mean, I'd hate to, you know, have it be like a PR issue about how we look compared to other agencies if it makes more sense to combine them. But if we have them separate, I'm still troubled by the names. Like, maybe if we called it like wholesale water or like even like transmission costs and then like localized cost or something, that might be helpful. And I am comfortable coming from the retail side with the buy-in concept of building it when it makes sense, and then having additional people pay to be part of that, because we can't wait for everybody to get there to build the thing, or we're going to, the timing won't work. It just seems to me overall, my overall observation is there's a lot of tracking. We should make sure that we get all of the money that we need, but I don't know that all the tracking is doing that right now. So I think there's some solutions needed.
One of the other suggestions by the ratepayer advocate was only do a 10-year look ahead instead of a build out look ahead, because then your data and your assumptions might be a little bit more accurate.
It just seems like we're trying to predict the construction industry, and that seems to be very difficult to predict. I just heard in, of course, another podcast about how inefficient they are and how behind they are compared to other industries that have gotten more efficient through the last 50 years. The construction industry essentially has flatlined on efficiency and then are way behind. So again, if we could control what we can control and charge accordingly versus waiting on them, right. I think that would be a goal.
So the idea of the last capacity fee, can you bring back the attachment A? It's the one you can't read.
The one that has all the, has a history on it. Yeah.
It's in the presentation. You can just. Okay. Yeah. So at build out, so if at any time, so, you know, maybe next year, maybe it's there's a housing boom and everything aligns and people are getting materials and the construction industry becomes more efficient and we get 5,000 connections. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, if we truly believe there's going to be additional 31,000 connections, we will have received $480 million that we thought that we said we needed to receive. The only thing is that, you know, it's slow because the assumptions, maybe the assumptions are wrong or need to change. They need to be updated. If we had a crystal ball, maybe we should have had slower growth in the beginning, so we weren't expecting as much and higher growth out to the end. And that's the way the model is supposed to work. So if we truly believe by 2051, we'll be at build out, we would have collected as much as we said we needed.
Right. It's just lamenting being ahead or behind in the middle doesn't make sense, right? Am I understanding that correctly? Because we'll get our money in the end if it works. Yes, that was my takeaway.
Dr. Almatar, do you have any thoughts?
So I feel like I have the steepest learning curve here on this. And so I am absorbing and trying to do a lot of learning quickly on this. And so I don't have any questions at the time, but I am going to need to spend more time with it. And I just want to say I appreciate you bringing this to us in chunks so that we can have these kind of step-by-step conversations and then build on them as you throw a new one at us next time or whenever the next time is going to be. So I very much appreciate that. I think that's very helpful for all of us. And I think it leads to more productive conversations and then better decision-making in the end. So thank you for that.
Thank you. You know, my experience with all this and the 20 years I've been in the valley, this valley, I always have thought the buy-in concept was probably the best for the situation. And as far as the regional facilities are concerned, that is a little bit tougher road, because it was always thought with these bosses and the black box, as they used to be called, how'd you figure that out? That's well, we'll have to give you a fine. So I'm always impressed. I've come back here again to this chart that we are actually almost receiving payments as half of what we are predicted to begin with. That's not meeting the goal. We hope, as Vice President Gutzeit says, we can even that out in the future. But we almost have to look at this almost every increment of years to really to understand where we're heading with these buying or the cost of recovery. I have not seen a whole. We still have to go in debt doing facilities. I wish we could not do that, as we have all would like not to do that, because of the lagging of the facility fees. That's reason why we go into debt. That's simple, that we need the facility now, or we need to upgrade the facilities because they've run out of their useful life, because we've been around here a long time now. So my thought has always been the wholesale retail type of connection fee. The wholesale has a whole different dynamic of expense and need. And the retail, of course, as you explained very well after your class, Courtney, is that it is only those facilities are really development-oriented facilities and should be cared for by the development. But the wholesale facilities, like expansions of treatment plants, and those are the ones that are really hard to get a grasp, to get a idea how to, you know, obtain funds from the development that causes that, but at the same time as the replacement of those facilities. So some of my thoughts, and Director Colley would like mm-hmm. to chime in now. Okay, go ahead.
So my view, the distinction between retail and regional fees is not related to development, because developers pay both. They used to come up here and pay lots of money, and to in order to be able to connect to the backbone system. Historically, the two were easy to distinguish, because you paid one to a retailer and you paid another fee to the wholesaler, and the terminology has sort of carried over. So, you know, looking at if we needed to differentiate between the two, to the extent that we still do, it's still not particularly difficult in my mind. It's just if the system that we're talking about paying for used to be paid for and maintained and whatnot by a retailer, then it was part of the retail fee. If it was taken care of by CLWA, then it was the regional. Having said all that, I think we ought to stop collecting two fees. I frankly don't even care if some paper is generated that makes it look like we're twice as high as anybody else. If the developers can't look at that paper and figure out that, oh, that's two fees in one, they are, you know, developers are not stupid. Well, most of them are not that stupid. And they will figure out the fees, and they will, if it makes economic sense for them, they will pay them. If it doesn't make economic sense for them, they will develop elsewhere. So I think that it's important that we get rid of the distinction between the two. We have one fee, and we move expeditiously towards that. That's my point of view. And I would say that in every other aspect of this new agency, we've agreed on that concept, that we do not want to have this concept from the old retail wholesale. We wish to merge and become more efficient as a single agency. So let's hopefully get rid of the two fees, go to one. I commented already on the need for the Whitaker Burmite WASA. Obviously, there's also a need for the far west end, because that area is being treated differently as far as recycled water and water, the creation of recycled water and all that. So that area, we pretty much have to treat differently because we've agreed to treat them differently. Sometimes that 3% inflation on the fees is mentioned at the same time that I try to understand the fact that we're no longer collecting back interest on things that we've already created. And to conflate those two is simply wrong. The idea of the 3% inflation factor is just we've assumed in the calculation that there will be inflation, and we accounted for it best we could. And that's appropriate, but it doesn't take into account the problem of us having to pay interest on debt that we incurred in order to build something for a future development. So I want to go in a little bit to that issue. The problem we face is that it is impossible to think that you would, you know, somebody comes along and says, I'm going to build 10 houses. And we say, okay, well, we need to create another aquarium size filtration plant for that 10 houses. Okay. And we could maybe take over the Upper Mesa. We could put, every time 10 houses are built, we could put a new little tiny baby filtration plant up there and charge a developer for that, and have some nightmarish filtration plant farm that, obviously, you know, I'm being a little bit ridiculous here, because the point is that you have to build, when you build a new filtration plant in a growing community, you have to build it larger than the current community requires. And so we have, in fact, expanded our filtration plants and spent many millions of dollars to do so, with an eye towards the fact that the future development will require that capacity. The idea that we pay the debt on an asset that is partially unused, that is also becoming less valuable over time. We need to talk to our lawyers really hard about that. That it's absurd that we should not be able to charge the developer for what we built and pay debt on, in order so that they can come along and build something. If we've guessed inappropriately, we built way in excess of need or something, then maybe, yeah, we ought to, you know, the ratepayers on the current ratepayers ought to be on the hook. But we need to be able to come up with some kind of a way to account for that cost. And I suggest one of my thoughts is that land is paying taxes. It's reduced, obviously, over that which a house pays. But perhaps those taxes, which are not being used to pay for water, ought to be accounted for in paying the interest. And rather than credit, you know, I think that we could figure out a way to balance that. I'm going to say that generally, we've never done a buy-in model. It was brought up as a possibility the last time around, and we didn't go that way. A modified buy-in model where we have 70% of the valley already developed makes the most sense in my mind. I think that this idea that we have tried to guess what we might be building for a possible future development and then billing for that, it doesn't make much sense to me. We don't even know what we're going to be developing or needing to build. We don't know the cost of it. We don't know. And in fact, the developer really isn't. That's not what they're buying. They're when they actually build a house, they're building a house that's using our current system. And so it makes sense that a buy-in that accounts for everything that we need to account for would make the most sense. The 30-70 split, that rule has kind of bothered me in the past, because not everything we build is 70% useful to the current users. I would point to when we built the expansion of the two treatment plants. The people that were in the valley at that time, for the most part, had sufficient or nearly sufficient treatment capacity. And so the expansion of the treatment plant should have been, and I think mostly was at the time, going to be allocated to the future developers. So we need to be careful with that 70-30 split, and making sure that where we apply it, it's valid. Not sure that it always is. Anyway, yes, I'm glad that we're having a conversation. It's something that I have been, the old black box. I all but beat on the table here for years, saying that the whole black box thing was crap and dumb and didn't work and wasn't reasonable. And then after years and years of my saying it, staff came and said that it was crap and it was unreasonable. And I was like, yeah. Our current system is not much better. It really isn't. It's for the most part arbitrary, frankly. So I'm glad that we're having a conversation, and I'm hopeful two things will come out of this: that we'll move towards a single fee, and that we'll move towards a modified buy-in approach. So I'll stop, because we're going to have more of these conversations. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Any rebuttals? Vice President Goodsite.
Oh, well, as long as you say rebuttal, then I will have to say that Newhall did have buy-in fees. For one, and I'm sure. So you said nobody had buy-in fees here.
Okay.
So a few clarifications or thoughts, but in general, again, it's time when I'll agree with you overall. But I want to make clear that when we say retail is for the developer, the retail fee is not the in-track cost. The developer pays all the stuff that they build. If they're building a housing track, they pay for all of that 100%. The retail fee was for any changes that the retail agency had to make to accommodate that development coming in, or like the what I call the load on the retail system in that area. And then Castaic, the old Castaic, did their thing for the wholesale costs. So there was actually three costs for the developer. They're building their own stuff and then paying retail and wholesale. I am in favor of simplifying the fee as much as possible. Acknowledge that maybe the WASAs are different for a reason, but I think maybe one base connection fee, just a base connection fee, and then a WASA fee or something. If one of them should be surcharged because it's all in the hills, or it needs something special. Not sure about the Whitaker-Burmite thing, but you know, if there's a special treatment for a certain area, maybe that's a surcharge for that area. But if we can simplify it, and I'm picturing like the end goal for transparency to be, you know, an essentially equipment list, which I think you did it right for the, when we did facility capacity fees, actually, and you did it for the Valencia fee. There's like an equipment list, right? This is what you're paying for, all of these things, these pump stations, these, you know, so you have your equipment list in the fee. And then if you're getting something extra, you got to pay for something extra. Then you have the second WASA fee list. And then maybe a picture. I'm the only one that wants a picture, but, you know, a nice picture. And then as far as that we can't charge for interest, I'm not sure. If you, did you say legal said we can't charge for interest, or where is that concept coming from that we can't charge for it?
We can't include any kind of like lost interest or lost revenue into a future fee, because then those developers are paying more than their fair share. So you can't roll it into your next fee. And that's the same issue with the black box. That's what that was doing. And it, you know, was very hard to defend.
Right.
So
like if we didn't, just going back to like your attachment, if we had 30 years of build out and nobody built except for like the last track, they're going to pay a ridiculous amount of money because nobody else paid in. That's what you're saying. They actually have to pay the cost of their service, not
right
what happened in the middle.
Right.
However, I'm thinking of, and you said it, see, again, agreeing with you. I don't know if a property assessment makes sense, but we did that for Tesoro, for that water that was held for them, right? Was it Tesoro where we had water?
They were outside the...
Yes, and we purchased the water, and they kept having to pay the interest on it. And that stuck with the parcels. So even when they went and sold, that cost was still recovered and they had to pay the interest. So some way of just long-term, I'm not saying that's the solution, but some way of, if we build this stuff in advance that is oversized, that the cost of building oversized upfront rather than having 100 little aquarium tanks of filters or 1,000 little aquarium tanks, that interest cost goes on to the developers to pay, not on our customers to pay. Whatever legal way we could do that. There has to be a way if we're building it ahead of time. I mean, they're getting it, although, you know, depreciation would still apply, but I mean, there's just see what we can do with that, because otherwise, our customers are paying for the oversized stuff, and that's not fair to our customers. We want to be fair to developers. We need to be fair to our existing customers, too. So somehow, if it's oversized for future growth, the future growth has to pay that added cost, including the interest of building it early.
That's the idea of the buy-in fee.
Oh.
So, right, you built it. I mean, yes, there's depreciation, but you built it. you add it to your asset report.
Right.
You reduce it by any capacity fees you've already collected, mm-hmm. because you can't double collect.
Right.
And then that becomes part of your buy-in fee. So you're taking that, dividing it by the rest of your meters for build out.
Right.
And that becomes your, now your buy-in fee.
But if they, if you build it 10 years early, don't they have to pay 10 years worth of having that thing sit there? Why not?
No, it's all timing. You just can't, you know, I'm not going to say anything about property tax portion for interest on parcels, because I don't know if we know what value would be and what tax rate it would be and how many, you know, maybe hundreds of parcels are in a WASA. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's going to be a discussion for later. But I mean, the interest cost is already in the capacity fee. So if we're talking about the debt, it's the principal and interest is already included in the fee that they pay. It is. It's part of the calculation.
But if they bought in, for instance, if everybody bought in right when it was built, that would cost us less than if they buy in 10 years or 20 years later, because that debt could be paid back by their buy-in fee. So somehow, how could we end up being as if they paid right when it was built? I don't know what that looks like, but that would be the fairest thing for our existing customers, right? Or does the cost go up by the cost of the debt, by carrying the debt for...
That was the policy of Castaic Lake Water Agency for quite some time. And that's one of the things that I've just been keep asking year after year for, you know, some sort of accounting for what happened to that and how are we accounting for that? The fact that we used to have this interfund loan that we said we're basically loaning to these future developers so that we can build the things that they're going to need now, because it's cheaper and better to build it in advance of need. But they're going to have to pay for that cost of us loaning the money to them. And we accounted for it very specifically in an interfund loan. And it was kind of interesting because some folks in the public got kind of just, I don't know, the whole thing got weird. And there were folks in the public that just grasped upon that great big number and were, I don't know, they became very vocal about it. And so the Castaic Lake Water Agency sort of just stopped. And I never understood how and why we stopped exactly. And I've asked for accounting for that for years. And I don't agree at this point that it's uncollectible, that our current ratepayers are forced to just eat that interest and cost that we incurred to do things like expand this treatment plant. And I don't see how we can say that it's in the current fee, because I don't see it. I having sat through the presentation, I didn't see it then and I don't see it now. So it troubles me a great deal.
Okay, thank you. Rochelle, we should probably move on here. We're going around in circles a little bit here. So next item on the agenda. Is item number 7, and that's the recommend receive and filing of the October 2023 monthly financial report. Ms. Patterson.
Yes, so this is through for the month of October and then year to date through October. So October, our revenue was under budget by $1.4 million. Our expenses were under budget by about $1 million. After our non-operating revenue and expenses, our change in net position is about $4.4 million. And that's mostly due to our CIP PAYGO not expended as we had projected in the budget. Our year to date, we are under budget in our revenue by $9.9 million. And we are under budget in expenses by about $6.4 million. And after we our non-operating revenue and expenses is included, our change in net positions is about $19.5 million, which is almost the $20 million that we are under budget in our CIP PAYGO. There, we also have our summary of investments. In the report, we show our three-month cash flow. We have our top 10 checks, just our, I didn't have much to report, so I'm just adding our top three checks that we had written in October. We had $1.8 million to Aqua JPIA for our auto and general liability insurance, a check to DWR for our variable charge for our state water project water, and a progress payment to Pacific Hydrotech for the Santa Clara Hombie wells. Those are the PFAS wells. And those were our top three checks for the month. And that's all I have to report.
Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Any comment from the board? Hearing none. Move on to number item number eight, our planning committee planning calendar.
Yes, so we are hopefully expecting to receive some proposals on December 13th, 2 days from now, for a ratepayer advocate. We had allocated most of our time for our January meeting to those potential ratepayer advocate candidates for interviews. So we'll see how many we may get. I believe only three consultants had downloaded the RFP. So hopefully we will receive some proposals back. We only had one other item in January, which was the tech services contract. And we kept it light just so we would have time for our ratepayer advocate interviews. And then we do have a just a few things coming up in February. So we were bringing in some changes to policies, which I had mentioned a couple months ago. We have some new legislation that we need to account for in our employee manual policies. It's also time to review our budget calendar, because that's, you know, coming up right around the corner again. Adding some internal control policies, and then we will be reporting on our in February, our December financials, our second quarter. That will kick off our budget discussion. Once we get those December numbers and have a mid-year, we will start doing looking at revising our fiscal year 24-25 budget. That's what we have for the next couple of months.
Any comments from the public?
No comment at this time.
Any comments from the board? No. Oh, and a question.
For the February, it says recommend approval of a water rate structure. What's that?
We're probably won't do that. We will have that discussion next year when we start the water rates. We'll prepare a cost of service study, and then we'll look at the same uniform volume rate or potentially going to a different rate structure, which would be a water budget. We'll discuss that next year. We'll take that off. We had that added because we weren't sure if we would have to do the rates a year sooner. So we'll just take that off the calendar.
Okay, item nine, requests for future agenda items. None? I guess I should ask for a public comment.
No public comment.
With that, item 10, general report on finance and administration activities.
I only had a couple things, and there's money left in the arrearage program. If you remember from a year and a half ago, we received about $650,000-ish that we credited back to customers that were in the arrearage during the COVID period. It went from March of 2020 through June of 2021. We received that money. We applied all of those payments back to the customers. Well, they have more, they still have arrearage money. So they've now expanded that arrearage program from June 6th of 2021 to December of 2022. We're not sure. We thought it was done of how to go back and calculate the arrearage, but Kathleen is on it. But so there's potentially some more money that could be coming to us that we will then apply to the customer's bill. So more to come on that. Also, the LIWAP program was extended. That was for customers that low-income customers that qualify. They could receive a one-time payment of up to $15,000. That was extended until March of 2024. It was going to sunset September, or I think it was, must be at the end of this year. They extended it a few more months because they still have money. And that's all I have for my report.
Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Any questions from the board? With that, we move on to item 11, which is adjournment. Thank you all.
Thank you.